Hi, everyone, and welcome back to part one of a supplementary video for the New Testament Survey course. This is a supplement to our survey of the book of Revelation. Now, there's one larger topic, but I've broken it up into two shorter videos instead of one long one. In this, we'll look in more detail at Revelation chapters 4 and 5 together. Chapter 4 in this section and chapter 5 in the next. And I've titled this passage, The Throne and the Lamb. We'll look mostly at the throne in this video and the Lamb in the next. But it's important to treat these two chapters together because they are one vision and they're intended to be seen together, as we'll see. So I suggest that you treat these two videos as just one section with an intermission. Now, these two chapters are an important passage that give the main story to help us understand the rest of John's fantastic visions in the book of Revelation. And this passage gives us a peek behind the scenes to learn what is driving all of human history, why these things are happening, and how it will all turn out. And so this passage is important for us to consider in some more detail. And I suggest that you keep your Bible open and read along and then follow along as we then work through these verses in detail. Chapter 4 of this passage says, After these things I looked, and behold, a door having been opened in heaven. And the first voice which I heard as a trumpet was speaking with me, saying, Come up here, and I will show you the things which will inevitably happen after these things. And immediately I was in the Spirit. And behold, a throne was situated in heaven, and there was one seated upon the throne. And the one seated had the likeness, similar in appearance, to a jewel of jasper and carnelian. And a circle of light around the throne had the likeness, similar in appearance, to an emerald. And around the throne I saw 24 thrones, and I saw 24 elders sitting upon the thrones, clothed in white garments. And I saw crowns of gold upon their heads. And from the throne went out lightnings and roars and thunders. And seven torches of fire were burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of God. And before the throne there was something like a sea of glass, similar in appearance to crystal. And in the midst of the throne and around the throne were four living creatures, full of eyes on the front and on the back. And the first living creature was similar in appearance to a lion, and the second living creature was similar in appearance to a young bull. And the third living creature was having a face like of a human, and the fourth living creature was similar in appearance to an eagle flying. And each one of the four living creatures, having six wings apiece, were covered with eyes all around and within. And they never had a pause day and night, saying, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord, the God, the Almighty, the one who was, and the one who is, and the one who is coming. And when the living creatures gave glory and honor and blessing to the one sitting upon the throne, the one living forever and ever, the 24 elders fell before the one sitting upon the throne, and they worshiped the one living forever and ever. And they placed the crowns before the throne, saying, O our Lord and God, you are worthy to receive the glory and the honor and the power, because you created all things. And because of your will, they exist and they were created. Now, there is so much here that even in the supplementary section, we can't cover everything. It would just take too much time to explain every detail and give all the argument and documentation for all of it to explain every symbol. So if you'd like to learn the details of every symbol and action, I have included detailed notes on this passage in the Bible Studies section of the Scripture Exegesis site, and I'll leave it up to each of you to decide how much you want to dive into all the details. But here we'll go as deep as we can in our limited time. We'll try to understand the main meaning and application of this passage and how it helps us to understand and respond to the book of Revelation as a whole. So with that in mind, let's try to put this passage into the larger context of Revelation. Remember that the purpose of the entire book was partly to encourage faithfulness in a suffering and persecuted church. And one of the ways to do that was to give the readers a glimpse behind the scenes of human history to see what is really going on. And it explains the foundation of history and gives the readers God's perspective about everything that is happening. Because sometimes we need a change of perspective to understand things correctly. Let me illustrate. Imagine you're lying flat on your back and a man wearing a mask is moving towards you with a knife. Now, change your perspective. This is not happening in a dark alley, but in a white hospital room. And the man in the mask is not a criminal maniac about to take your life, but a surgeon about to save your life. Seeing the same details from a completely different context, from a different perspective, changes the entire picture. And in the same way, seeing all of history, not as a bunch of unconnected, random events, but rather as the working out of a unified divine plan, this gives hope and encouragement and strength for us all. Now, let's examine how this particular passage fits into the larger book of Revelation. You might recall from the outline of the book that it consists of four main visions, and this passage is the first part of the second vision, the vision of heaven. And that means that this passage is building upon the introductory vision of the triumphant Christ and the seven letters encouraging the churches to faithfulness. And this also means that this passage, it sets the scene, it sets the context for the series of sevens that follow. It helps us understand the series of seals, bowls, etc., the unfolding of history, climaxing and concluding. It answers the question of how this victorious Christ fits into history, and how our history, especially the suffering the first readers were experiencing, how that fits with what the glorious risen Christ had accomplished, and how this all works towards the promised consummation. In other words, this passage gives a key part of the explanation of what God is doing in history, and how it all fits together and is working towards the final goal. This passage gives a key part of understanding how the gospel is applied in the church and in all of human history. Now, before we look at this passage more closely, let's try to get a picture of the overall outline of these two chapters and how the big picture works. First is a short introduction to the vision, where John heard the same voice that addressed him in the first vision, and he was instructed to receive what God would show him. And then the rest of chapter 4 is setting the stage for what will be described in chapter 5. Now, of course, it's important on its own, and it gives us great insight into the nature and character of God, as we'll see. But it's also important for us to realize that the reason John described all of this is to prepare for what will happen in the next chapter. And what is described in this chapter is the throne room of God. God's throne is the center and source for all the drama of human history. John described the throne of God and the one sitting on the throne, and then is a more detailed description of all the things around the throne, including 24 elders sitting on 24 thrones and four living creatures, among other things. And all the things around God's throne somehow demonstrate his greatness, holiness, infinite power, knowledge, and authority. And the continual activity described around God's throne is worship, because he is the creator of everything and therefore sovereign over everything. So the setting for the drama of history is God sitting on the throne as the sovereign king over everything and receiving worship from his creation. And then in chapter 5, in the setting just described in chapter 4, John then narrated the cosmic drama behind all of human history. And this drama focuses at first on a scroll in God's right hand. And a challenge went out to find anyone worthy to open the scroll. But no one in all creation was found worthy. And John responded with mourning and despair. But he was then comforted by one of the elders, who announced that the Lion of Judah, the root of David, had triumphed and was worthy to open the scroll. And that led directly into a vision of the Lamb. The Lamb is described as having been slaughtered, but the Lamb is also described as sharing in God's throne, having all power and knowledge. The Lamb took the scroll from the one sitting on the throne, and all heaven, and then all creation, responded with worship toward the Lamb, including the proclamation of why the Lamb is worthy and what difference this makes for history. Now, that is the overall outline of the larger passage. So now let's circle back to see the first part of it in more detail and try to bring out the significance of what this vision tells us. As I mentioned, the vision itself starts by setting the scene for the drama by describing God's throne room. And the point of the first part of this vision is that God is great beyond our comprehension. He's completely separate, completely different from any part of creation. He is awesome in every sense of that word. So after the brief introduction to the vision as a whole, the rest of this passage centers on the throne of God. However, in a sense, this vision purposely obscures as much as it reveals. See, God himself is barely described at all, and everything else is described in somewhat symbolic terms. It's kind of like this and appears like this. And this is all to show the utter transcendence of God, that he is beyond our ability to fully understand. He's not the same as anything else in reality. He's above and outside of the universe as we know it, even though he is intimately involved in it. He just has a different kind of existence than we do. He's God, and we're not. So the first thing John saw and described is a throne. And the throne is symbolic for authority, power, and sovereign rule as a king. And this throne is above all of heaven, which is above all the universe. So John's vision begins with a symbol of the highest authority in existence. There is nothing more powerful or influential than what John is describing here. And notice that everything throughout the rest of this vision is described in relation to this throne. Everything is around the throne or before the throne, and God and the Lamb are on the throne. And throughout the rest of the book of Revelation, God is rarely referred to as God. He's usually called the one sitting on the throne. And throughout the rest of the book of Revelation, every event and activity begins from the throne, and the throne of God is the source of every action. And we need this reminder that the throne of God is at the center of all reality. Contrary to popular opinion, I'm not the center of the universe, and neither are you. Our God, seated on his throne of authority and power, he is the center of the universe. And any worldview or mindset that does not have God at the center is somehow skewed and not fully connected with reality. And then next, John described the one sitting on the throne. And actually, I've called this a non-description, because as I mentioned, there's relatively little information given in the description of God, and it's given in highly symbolic terms and a number of steps removed from the full reality. God's described in symbolic terms, having an appearance similar to precious jewels, being dazzling in appearance. But of course, human words are inadequate to fully describe him. The reality of God is far beyond our ability to understand or describe. Now, what Revelation says is true, and we truly can know God, but only partially. And the language in Revelation is inadequate to give us a complete picture of his true radiance and glory. Because God is so transcendent, so holy, and separate from our ability to comprehend as to defy description. We cannot begin to comprehend God as he is in himself. We can only partially understand God from his actions and the way that he has chosen to reveal himself. Now, of course, the book of Revelation assumes all that had been revealed about God earlier in the Bible, and the rest of the book will continue to reveal God through the activity that comes from his throne. But God, as he is in himself, is just bigger and better than we can fully experience or comprehend. And that is why more of this chapter describes the things around the throne than describes God himself. Now, these things around the throne are all expressions of who God is, but in a sense more easily accessible to us because they're also a part of the creation of God. So now let's briefly look at the things around the throne. And like I said, everything else in this chapter is related to the throne of God. Of course, not meaning a chair, but referring to the one on the throne. All of creation comes from God and only has meaning and purpose in relationship to him. And because it all has reference to God, somehow everything else described in this chapter symbolically points back to something about him. John described a circle of light, possibly like a halo or a rainbow encircling the throne, except it's not multicolored like a rainbow, but similar in appearance to an emerald. And this represents an outward manifestation of the glory and radiance of God. He is so resplendent that his glory radiates outward. And around God's throne, John saw 24 other thrones, which of course also symbolize authority and power. You see, the underlings of God are also powerful and sovereign, but their authority and power all comes from God, and they're under his authority. And the number of thrones is symbolic, twice 12, which is the number of the tribes of Israel and the disciples of Christ. And sitting on the 24 thrones were 24 elders, clothed in white garments. Now, the term elder does not primarily refer to age, but to a position of trusted leadership and authority based on acquired wisdom and experience that often does come with age. Now, these were possibly glorified humans, but more likely they represent some kind of supernatural angelic being. And they wore white garments, which symbolize purity and moral uprightness. And they were wearing golden crowns on their head, which is another symbol of royal authority and power. They were entrusted with delegated authority over God's creation. It's not explained, but symbolized. And the creatures surrounding God were morally pure and had great power and authority. And therefore, this shows that God has even greater purity, power, and authority. And then John described lightnings and loud noises and thunders going out from God's throne. And this is a symbolic demonstration of the awesome power of God. And it points back to Exodus chapter 19, verse 16, to the displays of power that accompanied God's appearance on Mount Sinai when he gave the Ten Commandments and the covenant. And this demonstration of violent energy is a continual phenomenon around God's throne in heaven to symbolically show the overwhelming power of God. And there are seven torches of fire burning before the throne. And torches often symbolize giving light, but also searching out and knowing things. And there were seven torches. Seven is a symbolic number for completeness and perfection. So this symbolized that God's throne has and provides perfect and complete enlightenment. And these are also called the seven spirits of God, or possibly the sevenfold spirit of God. Now this phrase, seven spirits of God, will come up again in chapter 5, and so we'll examine it more closely when we look at that chapter. And before the throne, there was something like an expanse of glass that sparkled like crystal. Now, glass in that day was not completely see-through, but was kind of like the privacy glass they used for shower doors. So the overall picture of this expanse was something that separated God from creation, but also gave a partial view of his glorious greatness. It highlights the distinction between creator and creation. God is completely different from us, and we don't have access to him until he makes himself known to us. But at the same time, we cannot help knowing how marvelous he truly is, at least in part. And then finally, there were four living creatures, or living things, around the throne. And this makes reference to the four creatures that Isaiah described in his vision of God in Isaiah chapter 6. Their main characteristic, based on what they're called in the book of Revelation, is that they have life. They're called the living things, or the living ones. But their life is derived and dependent on the life of the one sitting on the throne. Now, because they're so near to the one who is the source of all life, they are characterized by living. And they're probably the kind of creatures called cherubim and seraphim in the Old Testament. And John described them as being full of eyes, which is a standard symbol for knowing everything. And each of the living things had six wings completely covered with eyes. And their individual appearance, in various ways, is symbolic of royalty, strength, intelligence, and speed, or possibly of compassionate care. See, the underlings of God are characterized by life and by having all these attributes, and therefore, God himself is characterized by an even higher degree of inherent life and a higher degree of all these characteristics. Now, all of these things are described as being around God's throne, and their characteristics say something about the nature and character of God, his greatness and transcendence above even the greatest of created beings. And this chapter continues with not only a description of the things connected with God, but with the continual activity around God's throne. First, John continued the description of the four living creatures by describing their activity, and then he expanded to narrate the activity of all of heaven. And the primary activity of heaven is worship. The heavenly creatures worshiped with their actions, and they worshiped with their words, their proclamations about God. The proclamations about God are the important content of their worship and should strongly inform the content and character of our worship. These chapters are a great textbook for us to learn how to worship. Now, John wrote that the living things, they never ceased day and night. Their nature and their delight is to continually praise God without interruption. And like the creatures in Isaiah chapter 6, they cry out, "Holy, holy, holy." And the repetition of this term three times means that he is completely holy. He is the epitome of holiness. And the word holy, in both the Old and New Testaments, it means to be completely separate, to be in a class by itself. There's nothing else like God. He's completely unique in his nature and character. Now, his creation can be in conformity with him in some ways, but only in a derivative and kind of watered-down way, for lack of a better term. Nothing else can truly be exactly like him. And because God is completely morally perfect, the word holy also has a secondary connotation of moral uprightness. So our God is perfect in every way, and there's nothing like him. And then continuing the quote from Isaiah chapter 6, the living creatures address God with three terms: the Lord, the God, and the Almighty. The Lord is reference to God's revealed name, Yahweh, the self-existing one. But it also emphasizes his authority and sovereignty. He is in charge of everything, Lord and Master. And the term God emphasizes his deity. He is divine. He's really God in a way that all the man-made gods are not. He is the one true God who really is God. And the term Almighty obviously stresses that he is all-powerful. There's nothing that he wills to do that he cannot do. He is infinitely more powerful than anything in heaven or on earth. And the living creatures also proclaim God's eternal nature. He is the one who was, and the one who is, and the one who is to come. And this is another reference back to God's revelation of his name as I am, the one who exists. God has always existed, and he will always exist. Everything else exists only because he does. God is the eternal, all-powerful, Holy One, Lord over all time and space. And the four living creatures spend all their time praising him and proclaiming his greatness in all of these ways, because he is the kind of God that he is. And then John expanded this description of heavenly worship to include more than just the four living things. He wrote in verse 9 that when they gave glory and honor and blessing to the one sitting on the throne, the one living forever, the elders worshiped as well. But let's not speed over this transition verse too fast. Look at verse 9. First, it explains that what the living creatures had been doing when they proclaimed God's holiness was giving him glory and honor and blessing. Now, this does not mean that they were somehow giving him something that he did not already have. It's not saying that he lacked something until they gave it to him. They are giving in the sense of recognizing, acknowledging, and rendering to him the glory and honor, etc., which he already has. Glory is a recognition of status and prestige. It's the deserved fame and admiration of which God is worthy. And of course, that's tied to the inherent glory of God. He has infinite splendor, which the creatures recognize and delight in. And honor, similarly, is an expression of esteem and reverence as the appropriate response to the God who's infinitely honorable in every sense of that word. And blessing is an expression of gratitude and thankfulness for all that God is and has done. It's to brag about how wonderful he is. And notice again that this verse highlights again that God is the one sitting on the throne, and that he is the one who lives forever. His sovereign authority and eternal nature are proclaimed once again in this chapter. And whenever the living creatures did this, which, as we learned earlier, was continually, day and night, without pause, the 24 elders also worshiped God in actions and words. First, they worshiped with actions. They fell down before God as a display of devotion and humility. And they worshiped. Now, this word worship has the connotation of bowing down prostrate, but it mostly emphasized the attitude of submission, the attitude that God is greater than I am, and I am delighting to recognize and acknowledge his greatness. And once again, it says that they worshiped the one who lives forever and ever. John is clearly emphasizing God as the eternal source of everything, who will continue to eternally reign as sovereign over everything forever. And third, they place their crowns before the throne. The elders signify that their own power, authority, and royal victory pales in comparison to the royalty, value, authority, and victory of the one on the throne. Their own power and authority is significant, but it is derivative and dependent on him. And all creation should share in that same kind of attitude, because God clearly is greater than we are, and we are completely dependent on him. And finally, in this chapter, the elders worship with their words. They proclaim that God is worthy of worship, and they listed some of the reasons why he is worthy. They addressed him as our Lord and God, echoing how the living things had addressed him earlier. He is the one with all authority, and he's divine, the rightful object of worship. And they proclaim that he is worthy. That means that he abundantly meets the standard of rightly deserving all acclaim and glory. If there were such a thing as a greatness, holiness, worthiness meter that accurately measured, I mean, that thing, the needle would be pegged. It is fitting and right to worship him and ascribe to him all the honor and greatness. He deserves more praise than we could possibly give him. And he is truly worthy to receive glory, honor, and power. Now, the phrase glory, honor, and power, this is similar to the earlier statement that the living creatures made, which we've already talked about. But the reason he is worthy that they proclaimed is that he is the source and creator of all things. Now, that's not the only reason that he is worthy, but it is a very significant reason which is highlighted in this passage. God is the authority over everything because he is the cause of everything. You know, think about it. Our word authority is related to the word author. Everything owes its existence to him and was created only because of his will, because he decided and purposed to create it. And so he has a right and ability to exercise control over everything. And that also means that everything exists because of God's good, loving purpose and for his glory. There's nothing that exists by accident. We're all here for a reason, and that reason is centered on God himself. Now, let's summarize what we've seen so far. At the center of the universe is God sitting on his throne. He's glorious beyond description and surrounded by things that demonstrate his greatness, perfection, power, and holiness. He is uncreated, and everything else that exists owes its existence completely to him. Everything is dependent on him and finds its meaning only in him. So no pretender that claims to be the ultimate authority really is the ultimate authority, because God is on the throne as sovereign king over all creation. And he is fully sovereign and in complete control of everything that happens. He's sitting on the throne, and he lives forever. And all of heaven acknowledges and proclaims his greatness, and that all the universe is dependent on him as creator. He is the source and center of everything that exists, and he is king, sovereign over everything that exists. And third, he's worthy of all worship. And the proper response to this God is to express our delight and submission to him, acknowledging his greatness and our complete dependence on him and love for him. He is holy, completely different, and better than all creation. And we should respond with awe and worship as the appropriate expression of all of these things. Now, of course, the revelation of God's greatness and sovereign control would bring great comfort and encouragement for John's first readers. But it would also bring an inherent tension, because they were living under persecution by the pagan authorities. See, all of heaven acknowledged and worshiped God, but much of the earth does not. God's authority and sovereign control is fully manifested in heaven, but to suffering Christians, it might have seemed that earth was completely out of control. So at this point in the vision, they may have been asking, if God is so great and powerful, why is this happening here? What is God doing about it? And those are understandable questions at this point. But remember, this is not the end of the book. This is not even the end of this vision. Remember, chapter 4 is setting the scene for the main drama of this vision, which is told in the next chapter. And so this is not even the end of this section, just the end of part 1. So in the next video, which is just the second part of this section, we'll continue with the rest of the story. But for now, let's review what we've seen so far. In this chapter, we learned God is beyond description. God is self-existent, and that means that we're dependent on Him for everything. God is creator, and that means we are debtors to Him for everything. And God is Lord of history. And that means we should get meaning from God's purpose. And all of that should cause a response of worship because God is worthy. Now, I hope that you've been prompted to participate in this worship as we've worked through this chapter. And like I said earlier, there's so much more in this passage that we could look at. But I hope that this has given you a solid understanding of the main ideas so far in this vision. And the next supplementary section is part 2 of this passage, where we will explore the cosmic drama that flows out of God's purpose for humanity and how it applies to every area of our life. And I strongly recommend that you check it out, or you won't fully understand the meaning of this chapter that we just studied, because all of this chapter is setting up for what we'll see in the next chapter. And I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for watching.